Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing, rating, as always. Coming up on this week's programme, how whales transport nutrients thousands of miles just through their pee. If you'd like to get in touch with the podcast, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of those comments at the end of the show. Before we move on to news round, you might know that I've started delivering AI courses to get through your to-do list and get things done. We have three events coming up, an in-person AI bootcamp in Dublin, one in Cork, and a special focus online workshop for HR, recruitment and training. If you would like to upskill in the area of AI and see what people are doing with this incredible technology, getstartedai.com is where you'll find out more. Okay, time to look back at the week's breaking stories from the world of science. We're joined by Dr. Laura Hayes from the School of Cosmic Physics at the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies, DIAS, and Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from the University of Galway. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Jessamine, has to do with endometriosis.
That's right, and a new possible treatment for endometriosis that's just been approved in the UK. So endometriosis is a really horrible condition where tissue that is like the uterine lining in women grows outside the womb. So it's very painful. It can lead to things like painful periods, pelvic pain. It can even affect fertility. And to me, one of the things that's really scary about endometriosis is actually that the delay between when people's symptoms first appear to their biopsy and diagnosis is actually on average about 7 years. So people are suffering this for a really, really long time before they get taken seriously and treated. And actually about 10% of women globally are affected by endometriosis, which is a huge, huge number. Previous treatments that have been used, I mean, it's painful. So the first line of defense is painkillers, right? And it's induced by hormones. So sometimes people will be asked to take the birth control pill or even hormonal injections in a clinic every 3 months and, you know, at worst, surgery. And all of these things can help, but often the pain just persists. You need something that's able to reduce the production of estrogen that contributes to this tissue growing. But you also need to provide replacement hormones because, you know, estrogen is important for lots of things in women's bodies. So this new pill that's been approved in the UK is really exciting because it's actually just a daily tablet that you take at home. It's this thing called Relugolix combination therapy. So it combines an estrogen blocker with other things that help replace the estrogen in a woman's system. And it's just a pill that you can take at home daily. So it starts working more quickly than these injections people would have previously gotten in a hospital. And it returns your hormones to normal faster when it stops. So in terms of managing fertility, it works a lot better as well. And just being able to actually treat this condition like at home is an incredible step forward. This has just been approved in the NHS for people who've tried every other treatment. So there's still quite a long road. But to me, this is a big step forward in endometriosis, which is this condition that, you know, sometimes people don't talk about, but it really just affects such a large number of people.
Yeah. And I think due to the lack of focus, I think, on women's healthcare historically, also one of those conditions that didn't really get an enormous amount of attention.
Yeah, funny because, like, you know, pills are great, but that's not really why there's such a long time between the symptoms starting and diagnosis, right? So, you know, there's also the question of actually just believing women about their pain, but there's not a convenient pill for that. That's something that we're going to have to work on in other ways.
Indeed. Is this something that... it's not a cure, right? It's managing endometriosis. And but if you take it for a while, is endometriosis one of those conditions that goes in waves?
Well, so it's basically like managing the growth of these additional tissues, right? And that's why, you know, all of the hormonal treatments are going to be better long term than surgical treatments, which can remove some of the tissue, but, you know, aren't going to prevent more tissue from growing. So long term hormonal treatments will be better. But, you know, you can't just take the birth control pill. Like, that's not really tuned to the problem of endometriosis. So it's really big news that there would be a take-at-home daily pill to be able to treat this. And the hope, I mean, long-term, would be that this would really help manage the condition. But you're right, it's not a cure.
Amazing. Our second story, Laura, is something not unrelated, I suppose, something we didn't think about relation to health, which is astronauts' health when they're away from space. And this is... I guess good news. The astronauts that have been stranded for 9 months are eventually back. But there's a number of things that go with staying in space for a while, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the news we've had last week is kind of a remarkable and somewhat unusual mission, which I think, you know, grasped people's attention that these astronauts went to space for 8 days and ended up staying there for 9 months, right? So, you know, if you're ever scared...
I did that in Ibiza in 1996.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the same tells on your body, Jonathan, really. But I guess being... being in space that long, right, you have to think about it's a very different condition to being on Earth, right? One of them is that we don't have the same gravity, and gravity does huge things to our body. It's how we evolved, it's how we kind of live every day and how we grew up. So I guess not having this gravity every day, and especially for longer periods of time, you know, astronauts usually go for 6 months, but 9 months is a very long time. Things like muscle and bone loss, right? So without the gravity, the muscles and bones will weaken, even doing daily exercises. So, you know, astronauts do their daily exercises and you can lose up to, you know, 20% of your muscle mass over that time, which is huge, right? Especially when you're a little bit older.
They're going to feel really heavy when get off that, you know, when they finally wake up in their bed and put on their slippers in the morning, they'll feel really, really heavy. Like 20% of muscle mass is not a joke. Like that's an extremely large amount of the tissue that kind of helps you move around.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't even imagine. It must be like waking up with a weighted vest and you're trying to do anything, pick up a glass of water, you know, even just walking is crazy. And even other things like, you know, fluid buildup, right? If we are standing, gravity pulls all the fluid in our bodies down, but astronauts, they have fluid chips throughout their body. And one of them is they have vision issues, right? Because you actually have fluids that build up in your head and into your eyeballs actually can have significant issues with your eyes. Now, they have been seen that, you know, when they come back to Earth, that usually kind of reverses, but there are those type of effects. Similar things like your heart acts different in microgravity, right? So, you know, how does that affect you going long term? You have very low blood pressure, things like this. And then, of course, radiation exposure, right? You don't have this protection of the Earth's atmosphere. And again, the ISS, the International Space Station, is where these astronauts were, is not that further away from Earth. It's 400 kilometers in altitude. So we're not talking even into deep space. But even then, we don't have the full protection. So you have radiation risks. So cosmic radiation, if there's a solar storm, and this can have, you know, significant damage long term for cancer risks. So yeah, I mean, it's not exactly a health journey going to space. But yeah, I guess these are things that are really monitored when the astronauts get back. Now, the astronauts got back earlier this week. They're going straight to, you know, to be kind of monitored for their physical activity. And they'll go on a very long journey of, I guess, coming back to health after that time.
There are ways to mimic gravity on a spaceship, right? I think Star Trek came up with most of them. A sort of a centrifugal spinning thing through Earth would give us that sense of gravity. And presumably, if we managed to figure out a ship that would do that, it would also replicate the conditions that would mean that we wouldn't have these issues. Is that right?
Yeah. I think, you know, we really have to think about this if we're going to go to somewhere like Mars, right? Where you're going to be in space for an extended period of time. Like, it's not just going to be 6 months, it's going to be several years. So how do we do this? I mean, you can even see them on the space station, how they kind of like overcome gravity is they tie themselves down to a treadmill, right? And actually one of the astronauts, Sunny Williams, who came back earlier this week on a previous mission, she was the first person to run a marathon in space, which I thought was very cool. Now, maybe it was easier anti-gravity, but again, if you look at the video, she's like being held down by suspenders onto the treadmill.
I think space is the only place I would ever manage to do a marathon. I would want to have like zero gravity and zero effort. Our third story, Jessamine, is a really interesting one. It has to do with ants and how ants have solved a problem that humans have not.
Yeah, so if you think about ants crawling around on the ground, you know, they make their little highways. They're very good at making paths in between their anthill, different sources of food, and they use pheromones or scent chemicals to communicate, right? To say like, oh, there's food over here. There's some good stuff here. Don't go that way. And if you imagine ants moving along, you know, they're always
flowing,
right?
You kind of whiz through that, but I don't think everyone knows that, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think everyone fully understands how ants communicate with each other. So would you spend a little bit of... Does it explain that for us?
Yeah, absolutely. That like basically ants are emitting pheromones to send like chemical messages to other ants to say where to go. And that's why they seem so smart in a way. You know, like you'll get one ant coming into your house to like nibble at a little crumb that you've left behind. And all of a sudden there's like a huge trail of them. And you're like, how did they get in here this quickly? It's almost a kind of distributed intelligence, but that's being communicated between them using chemicals, using scents. It's very clever, and it's also sometimes very inconvenient if you've left jam out. But the thing that's interesting about ants, right, is that they're always able to sort of keep moving and to flow around and make these kind of decisions because they have this sort of distributed intelligence. So new research that is really interesting out of the University of Trento uses ants to try to understand how self-driving cars could potentially avoid traffic jams. So the thing is, you know, ants never get in traffic jams, right? Like, they're moving along. They're able to flow actually in like very dense kind of columns of ants moving around. And the thing about traffic that we experience, you know, in cars, on highways and freeways and all of this, is the more density of cars you have, the more likely it is that you start to have jamming effects where, you know, like cars are flowing along, but then suddenly one person like brakes really quickly, and then that causes the person behind them to brake and the person behind them. And if you kind of imagine looking at it from the top down, you almost see this like wave of congestion passing through cars where one person's like ill-advised braking starts to cause slowdowns. And you can actually get what researchers call phantom traffic jams, where it's a traffic jam, but like there's no accident. There's no like road construction. There's nothing that caused it. It's just something that happens.
I've been in one of those. The N7 has loads of those. Every time I'm on the N7, there's like this phantom wave, like you're waiting for hours and hours, and then you get it and you're like, wait, what? There's nothing here.
Yeah. No, exactly. Like, it's just the density of cars. But like, this never happens to ants, right? So why? Why is that? And so these researchers basically recorded a bunch of ants on foraging trails, these small black ants that are native to Australia. And then they analyzed them using traffic engineering models to look at, like, how is their movement different from what we do on highways? And what could this give us in terms of information for autonomous cars to potentially avoid traffic jams? So what they found about the ants, right, is that these ants, they travel in what the researchers called rafts, or like little groups of like 3 to 20 ants that move at constant rates. They don't speed up to pass other ants. They're like, I'm happy with my place in the line. It's all right. They don't tailgate other ants. So even these rafts don't get too close together. And of course, they're able to do this because they're communicating with the other ants around them, right? Using this scent system that we talked about. So, you know, there's no leader. It's a distributed system. Of course, we can't do everything that ants can do on highways because, you know, ants can, for example, they can make highways wider by going more ants across. We can't really do that, or we'll get in trouble if we try. Ants can also walk on each other, which cars really shouldn't do. And even if you try to like create a traffic jam by getting ants into a really tiny tunnel, like they're able to walk up on the ceiling, which again, don't try that with a car. Not a great idea.
It sounds like we can learn nothing from ants about how to avoid traffic jams.
No, I think the thing that's interesting is if we go back to things like, you know, tailgating and overtaking, right? So these are things that we do probably because we're in a hurry, but we might be trying to make things faster for ourselves, right? For the car that we're in. We think, I need to get around this slow car. But you're actually making things slower for every single car behind you. You're causing traffic jams by behaving in that kind of way, and ants don't do that. So that's the practical takeaway.
Okay.
Tailgate.
I'm not sure I'm sold on that story at all, but it was cute. Our final story, Laura, is an interesting one because it refers to a phenomenon I've never heard of, so-called white holes.
Yeah, this is actually a really interesting story that, you know, I, as an astrophysicist, also didn't know too much about white holes. And I came across this study recently that was published by researchers in the University of Sheffield. So we may know about black holes, right? There's a region in space that gravity is so strong that nothing, not even light, can escape, right? It sucks everything in, as you would imagine a black hole would do. Extremely massive. We've known about them for a long time. But there's some kind of problems with black holes. The idea is that with a black hole, it pulls in everything so small out and gets really, really, really dense to a point that we call a singularity, where it's infinitely dense and infinite gravity there. But that has a paradox, right? How do you have, in quantum mechanics and this other type of realm of physics, information can't be lost. So the whole idea is, well, where does that information go if it falls into a black hole? That's a paradox that we have. We try to understand this from a physical sense.
Yeah.
These researchers kind of use this other approach of kind of looking at the mathematics of it, and really saw when you actually go down to that really singular point, that infinite point in a black hole, quantum magic happens, right? Quantum mechanics is this magical thing, I guess, in some sense of trying to understand it from a classical viewpoint is really challenging. But it doesn't go down to this singular point. It actually has this little wave that happens, and basically it reverts and turns it back in on itself and basically expands out to be a white hole, spitting everything back out. So as the name would suggest, black or white, a white is basically, you can think about it as an opposite of a black hole. Basically shoots out everything. You can't fall into a white hole, right? Maybe if you fell into a black hole, maybe you pop back out in a white hole. I don't know. But this is kind of a really interesting concept and really kind of opens the ideas of how we can understand black hole physics and gets rid of this paradox for understanding what happens if you fall into a black hole.
But how come we don't see white holes? Like, do black holes, because they suck in all the light, is it possible the white hole is the dark side of the moon, so to speak?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I think maybe it could be to do, like, we've recently been able to observe a black hole, right? You can't necessarily see something that's not there, right? It sucks in light, but we can see light being sucked in. So the idea is now, this is purely theoretical, this white hole theory, but maybe we can go and start looking for dead black holes and seeing if they start to re-emit light. In theory, you would think that it would be easier to see a white hole than a black hole. So I guess this is maybe something, you know, we need to start thinking about. You know, we have now seen black holes, but maybe we can go and observationally prove this theoretical idea of a white hole. But still early days, and I don't know, watch this space. Maybe someday we will see an image of what a white hole looks like.
Very cool. So that's the first time I've ever heard of that. And it's probably lots of people on the program, the first time they've ever heard of a theoretical white hole. Remember this day. Dr. Laura Hayes from the School of Cosmic Physics at Dias and Dr. Jessamyn Fairfield from the University of Galway. Thank you very much. We often think about the trees of the planet, the Amazon forest and so on, as being the lungs of our world. But there's lots of other major contributors to the health of our planet. And one is probably more surprising than the rest. That is whale pee. Joe Willman, who's a biologist at the University of Vermont, he co-led this research. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Joe. Did you stumble upon whale pee, or is whale pee a major focus of your work?
Yeah. So thanks, Jonathan. Well, as it turns out, I started on whale poop.
Of course.
Maybe 20 years ago, collecting feces. We could see it, right? So it wasn't easy to collect, but it was visible. We found lots of nutrients in it. And what we proposed at the time is that whales create what we call a whale pump. They feed at depth, come to the surface, and release manure at the surface where phytoplankton can pick it up. That's where the story started. But then we got to thinking that...
Wait. Actually, I have some questions already.
Yes, please.
Are you saying that whales only poop at surface level?
On average, they poop higher than where they feed. It's really energetically expensive for them to dive deep. They actually shut down a lot of their digestive system when they're in a deep dive. So it's at the surface where they have to come to breathe, where they rest, where they digest. And often, just before they dive, we see them poop right in front of us.
Okay. And if you can help us visualize that for the more immature members of our audience, how big is a whale poop?
That's a good question. Sometimes these plumes can be as big as the Zodiac, the small boat that we're using. Sometimes it's clumped in.
I don't know how big that is, though. How big is that?
Yeah, so maybe 10 meters, but like a plume that could be 10 meters or maybe 20 feet long. Now, that's very...
Okay, I don't know why I was imagining a solid stool, but it's not a solid.
They can do that too.
Oh, can they?
So right whales, it depends on when they're eating, just like any other animal. If they're eating sort of fatty copepods or invertebrates, then you'll see it floating at the surface, kind of like brown or red bricks. And those are the easiest for us to collect. And quite frankly, why we focused on those, because we could see them, we could collect them, and we could test them.
I hate this subject. I don't know why I was asking questions. Like, So you were interested in that because obviously, trying to understand these whales that spend so much of their time out of sight. This is a great insight to be able to harvest what was in their guts to understand what they ate. But what else can you learn from whale poop?
Yes, sure. Also the hormone levels. So we know if the females are pregnant, we can tell if they're stressed. One study from 2001 just happened to be on the water after 9/11, after the terrorist events, when the ocean went quiet. Terrible time for humans, but the whales, actually, they sort of had a much lower stress levels because the oceans were quiet for a while. So you can look at stress, you can look at reproduction. And now what we're looking at is the gut microbiome. That's our most active project right now. So how, we know these are the largest animals ever to have lived on the planet, but just like us, they rely on tiny microbes in order to break down the food and perhaps in order to help them undergo these vast migrations that we'll talk about.
Right. So when these animals move, they move quite a bit, right? These are the largest migration paths of any mammal on the planet. How far would they migrate, a baleen whale, for example?
That's right. I mean, one of the longest is from off the coast of Russia down to the coast of Mexico. So maybe 10,000 kilometers. They travel, many of these species travel thousands of kilometers every year. One group that we focus on moves from Alaska to Hawaii. And then in the southern hemisphere, humpbacks and other species move all the way from Antarctica up to places like Colombia. So across half the planet. Every year.
Wow. And do we know why they do that? Because, I mean, I would have thought they wouldn't need to go so far to find shallow water, warm water, you know, safe water. Why do they do that?
Yeah, so the short answer is we don't know, but we have some hypotheses. So one is to avoid predation. So a full-grown humpback whale, it's unlikely a killer whale, which is their main predator, can attack a full grown, but they can attack the calves. So when the calf is first born, it's quite vulnerable. So we think one reason is the moms go down to these shallow, sandy, warmer waters in order to have their calves. That protects them from the third dimension. Killer whales can't attack them from below. And it's also quieter there because it's sand. So, you know, it's almost like having a rug underneath you. So when they're communicating by sound, those sounds aren't going to travel as far. There's even one hypothesis that they go down there as something like a spa because they get rid of the fouling organisms that grow in highly productive areas and they slough that skin. And so maybe those warmer waters also help them have improved skin health, for example.
Right. Obviously, it feels like an exhausting thing to do for me, but this is obviously baked into their evolutionary procedures. And so this is just something that they do. And as a part of this, and this is what the research that you have recently published, as part of this, they carry an enormous amount of nutrients with them. I was looking at the figures here and it didn't seem right. I mean, like it seems extraordinary the amount of nutrients these animals move around and that they might have an effect on whole ecosystems just from their urine.
That's right. And we didn't know about the urine when we started. I mean, we knew that urine was going to be part of the story when we began this research. We didn't know it would be the sort of the main part of the story. So how do they move these nutrients? Again, largest mammal on the planet, traveling long distances to have their calves. A whale placenta is several hundred pounds. So that's one way of just directly releasing biomass and nutrients into the system. They're also releasing skin. You see skin sloughing all the time, and we see fish feeding on that skin and birds as well. And then infant mortality in whales, as it is for other mammals, is high. So the carcasses of the calves that don't make it and the carcasses of the adults all bring lots of biomass. And by one calculation, just to Hawaii alone, about 4,000 tons of biomass each year from one species, humpbacks, that's like 10 million Big Macs every year. So it's a lot of food. But what we found that outweighs all of this actually is urine. So why is urine important? One, it's directly providing available nitrogen and phosphorus to the local ecosystem. And whales are producing a lot of it because having a calf, a 1 or 2 ton calf, is energetically expensive. You have to go through gestation and then birth and then lactation, and they're feeding these whales, you know, tons of food all the time. So the combination of that, they're breaking down their blubber and their proteins, their muscle mass, and they're releasing that, the nitrogen they don't need, into the marine ecosystems. And that can be picked up by phytoplankton, by marine algae, maybe even coral systems, and ultimately passed through the whole food web in an area like Hawaii or the Caribbean or off of Colombia and many places around the world.
Do we know the effect of all of these nutrients? Obviously, they provide, as you say, they provide nitrogen for the growing of plants and so on. Do we have good info on either places where, for example, there were whales and there are not whales anymore? Do we see what sort of an effect removing this nutrient-rich giant pea field, what it does to animals?
Yeah, so that this is still at the early stage, and that the next step is to do look for chemical signatures in the corals or in the phytoplankton, and to look for changes in phytoplankton blooms. And another great area would be off the coast of Western Australia, where there are now, I think, 25,000 humpbacks. They were down to just a couple of hundred at the peak of whaling. So we have to keep in mind, one way we're looking at this is whales used to be very abundant. Then in the 60s and 70s, many populations came very close to extinction, and now we're seeing that return. That's the good news, is we want to look at these changes. At this point, it's modeling. It's saying, okay, we know this nitrogen is getting into the system. We see it. We see evidence. We see whales peeing. That's been through new video techniques that we have that have just been mind-blowing. How do we see whale pees? It's kind of hard, but colleagues of mine are putting cameras on the back of humpback calves, and these are suction cups, so they don't hurt the whale. And then we can see the whales nursing, and we can see the moms peeing, and we're seeing these nutrients go directly into the water. And the fish, by the way, are responding to this. You can see the fish rush in looking for spilt milk, for example, from the calves. So the next step for us is really, how do the ecosystems respond? Now we're showing this pulse, and that next we've got to see, okay, can we see evidence that phytoplankton is responding? We do know, based on our estimates, that the amount of nitrogen these whales are bringing into some areas is more than that's being transported through physical processes like wind and upwelling. So it's a lot.
I mean, that's incredible that one species could be responsible for more than the natural physical movement of the ocean. That's crazy.
Exactly. And those were the sort of the surprises. And again, a lot of this is coming through the urine, which is hard to see. So that's why often it's a lot easier to test something like whale feces, because we can't really collect the urine, or at least to date, we don't know how to collect it responsibly. We don't want to get close to the whale. There have been some studies, most of the studies looking at whale urine have been from whaling areas, in particular Iceland, where, you know, they have a fresh whale, and some scientists have looked at the urine, and it's given us ideas that a fin whale, for example, probably pees about 250 gallons a day.
What's a gallon in liters?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. So like 1,000 liters per day. And humans do we pee about 2 liters.
Wow.
It's a lot. And we also think they're probably peeing all the time. If you have a dog, you know that it's like that there's a certain time when the dog goes out and you're walking it and it pees, or maybe it's marking its territory. For whales, we suspect they can pee whenever they need to, that probably they don't, you know, release it at any particular time or any particular place. But who knows? There is evidence that dolphins, for example, have chemical signatures in their urine, so they can identify other dolphins through the chemical mixture in the pee. So who knows? Maybe that's true for baleen whales as well, like humpbacks, but we don't know that.
Yeah, I love this, the great whale conveyor belt, as you call it. But I'm wondering, you know, we spoke only recently about how the wolf as an apex predator has a trickle-down effect on the entire landscape of an environment. So, for example, Yellowstone is the famous example. I'm wondering, do we need to consider whales in this way too? That if whales go back to being in trouble, what sort of effect this will have on the general health of the ocean worldwide?
A big impact in one example. There are what's called whale falls. So when whales die, you know, they're enormous. We don't have large trees in the ocean, but we have large animals. And when whales die over the deep sea, their entire ecosystems depend on those what are called whale fall communities. 100 species have been found on whale fall, on dead whales, and nowhere else on the planet. So there are whale fall specialists that rely on these whales. The whales are also bringing nutrients, just like they bring nutrients to the tropical regions. They're also bringing it into the deep sea. And they're particular species dependent. And then they also act like stepping stones. You've probably heard of hydrothermal vent communities, which are unique in the deep sea. We think that some of those species might use dead whales as stepping stones between different hydrothermal vents. Keep in mind, the adults aren't moving. They're only moving in their larval, in their juvenile stage. But it's essential to have habitat in that deep sea. We estimated that some of the earliest extinctions in the ocean might have occurred in these whale fall communities before we even knew they existed.
Wow. God, it's fascinating. And while it doesn't sound like the most glamorous job in the world, chasing after animals, waiting for them to pee and poop, amazing what you can learn from just looking at something closely, which is, I guess, the whole point of this program. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you, and thank you so much for your time. That's Joe Roman, biologist at the University of Vermont. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Jonathan.
All right, time to look back at some of your comments from last week. And we had this incredible interview with Lorena Nachi, who was taking part in a study where they were trying to understand consciousness and when it arrives in babies. And she said at the end of the interview that she had actually put her own child in an MRI scanner for this research, which I thought was crazy. Jane says, hearing that scientist speak about putting her own baby in the MRI for analysis was so interesting. It's taking experimentation and dedication to the science to a whole new level. How much are they able to monitor the baby's reaction once they get into the MRI? Well, I believe they're swaddled clothes. That's what Lorena said. They're swaddled clothes and they're held in place, but it's only a short period of time. So Lorena said the baby was totally fine. So I don't think we need to worry about it, but it's a brave thing to do, but absolutely for science. Another says, what is the difference between consciousness and awareness? That, my friend, is an ecumenical matter. Awareness, I think, is an ability to understand that something is there. Consciousness is, I believe, includes a sense of self and a sense of your place in the world and a subjective experience. Being aware of something else doesn't necessarily require that, I don't think. If you are an expert in, I guess, philosophy or neuroscience and you want to counter that, please do email us, science@newstalk.com. We were also talking about octopuses and weird mating with Wen Sung Chung. They do some crazy stuff. Grace says, Jonathan, that sounds a lot like human mating to me. Depends on the person, Grace. Depends on the person. And Orla says, the concept of octopus mating being such a dangerous affair for the male is actually mad. Makes me appreciate their role in the ocean ecosystem even more, knowing that they give everything to continue the species before they die. Well, they die unwillingly. They die and get eaten, I suppose, Orla. Thanks for your comments. More to science@newstalk.com. And that's it for this episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin, and Hugo da Silva on sound. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.